From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, behind the compromise that could head off looming problems for the War Memorial and Milwaukee Art Museum. Later, examining the sticker shock when it comes to electric cars.
I'm getting all the technology in there, and that's what's running the cost up. It's not that it's bigger. It's not that it has fantastic other features in it, but it's a good car at what it does, but it also has this new technology.
And a major part of Susanna Daniels' new novel is inspired by a significant part of her own life.
I think that anyone who has any kind of minor illness wonders what will it be like if that illness just takes a turn. And I actually could see that happening as an insomniac. I could see it becoming much worse over the course of my lifetime. And it scares me.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening today. Advocates for two Milwaukee institutions are optimistic about their future. That's after a compromise agreement was reached recently to provide long-term county funding for both. The deal would provide $1.6 million in annual funding for a decade to the War Memorial Center and the Milwaukee Art Museum. They've both been wrestling with looming maintenance problems, leaky roofs, crumbling concrete. Each group would have separate leases with the county, and the deal would change the governance board that oversees the facilities. The agreement was passed unanimously by the county board, though it could still be vetoed by county executive Chris Abley. He's complained about the costs involved and changes in oversight. Joining us in the studio are Milwaukee Art Museum Director Dan Keegan, War Memorial Director David Drent, and County Board Chairwoman Marina Dmitrievich. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Why was it so vital that this issue come to a resolution?
I'll start with that. Well, this is really a historic, monumental agreement for Milwaukee County. It took nearly 18 months for the War Memorial and Art Museum to come together because of the significance of this agreement. And when they did, we now have an agreement that'll pay off for future generations in Milwaukee County. Having these two institutions work together will make it more sustainable. It'll have capital improvements, and it will really pay off for Milwaukee County. So it's important that we move forward on this as soon as possible.
And I would add, these are historic changes that have actually been underway or in progress for the entire nearly 60 years that we've been located together at the lakefront as the War Memorial and Art Museum, and a natural progression of growth, advancement, and development.
Well, and so let me ask you this. Why has it been difficult to work together at the level that this agreement represents in the past, and what has changed that will make it possible today?
Well, it's complicated. But to simplify it, I think it's important to recognize that the conditions of the buildings played a major part in this. And we're, of course, deeply grateful for Milwaukee County's support, and we can get into that in making the repairs to the buildings. But a necessary part of this timing is to take a look at the organizational structure and see if there aren't some things that can't be done in terms of the organizations, and they're working together and also working independently in a new way.
Well, so what does that really mean?
Well, I believe that the current governance structure is – it's not clear enough. I think these new agreements will be able – they separate the organizations governance-wise. So while staffs are working together and boards are working together, we will be governed by the War Memorial Board, and the Art Museum will have the freedom to be governed by their own board. And there won't be politics being played at the board level.
The other thing I would add very briefly is that one of the big changes that's taken place over the decades is the growth of the Art Museum. Whereas it was under the wing initially of the War Memorial back in the 1950s, today the museum occupies 340,000 square feet of space across the three buildings, two of which are owned by the county. And so that growth and that responsibility that the museum has to maintain museum-caliber environments is something that seemed to make sense to both parties now to make that organizational change.
The measure passed unanimously on the county board, though not without debate. It still faces objections from the county executive. His line, which some others in the community have echoed, is that the deal is simply too expensive for taxpayers. So let me turn that question around. Why do you see it as not too expensive for taxpayers?
Yeah, I think that is a short-sighted comment that lacks a forward-thinking progressive vision. And why I say that is, let's not talk about what might be wrong with the deal. Let's talk about what we are doing. We're making a long-term commitment in this community to a world-class arts institution and a very important memorial to our veterans. Having those two groups work together and making a significant investment is, I think, an incredible role of Milwaukee County. And so, again, protecting the art and bringing down private funding for the Art Museum and the War Memorial and enhancing the services at the War Memorial, this is a great investment to make. Mitch, we barely do things unanimously in Milwaukee County government. It's a significant statement. You have the arts community, the veterans community, and people throughout Milwaukee County who support this. I just think it's unfortunate to be on the wrong side of this issue.
Governance aside, talk about how the War Memorial will evolve under the terms of this agreement.
Well, Mitch, I think we've done a really good job on veterans programs. We just don't – the community doesn't know about it. The veterans know about it. I think what we are going to be able to do is we're going to be able to expand those programs. The veterans that are coming back now have a completely different set of issues than the World War II veterans have. And we're not going to provide services, but we're going to help people get to those services. And I think another thing is that, you know, we've all talked about deferred maintenance. For years and years, we've talked about deferred maintenance. I think the level of funding that we will receive from Milwaukee County with these agreements will help us to better keep the buildings up and to hopefully, you know, cut those long-term costs down.
One of the concerns that's been voiced in the past by some on the county board even is around the War Memorial's ability to cut future operating costs and or raise more in donations. What is your take on those two issues?
Well, we are a service organization that houses 800 events a year. We want to make it right for the people that use the War Memorial Center. We are the caretakers of the Milwaukee County Pearl. And we believe that we have gotten our costs under control, and I think you'll see that in the future.
Dan Keegan, you know, there are a lot of publicly supported cultural institutions, public radio included, that often hear the argument that they ought to be doing whatever they can to wean themselves from being connected to the taxpayers. Are you at all sensitive to that issue, and how does this agreement speak to that call?
Well, I think that's an interesting and oftentimes misguided notion, this idea of weaning. Here's the fact that I remind people of. The Milwaukee Art Museum charges $15, $16 for admission. It costs us $45 a year per visitor to run the museum. So the museum is raising significant dollars, millions of dollars annually to keep those costs for our daily visitors as low as possible. And in this particular project, the important thing for us is this joint partnership with Milwaukee County to make the deferred maintenance repairs. And the museum provides $15 million in renovations and improvements to the buildings. That's a win-win for everyone.
Marina Dmitrievich, you spoke about why you see the commitment to veterans as being so important. Let me ask you about the other part of it, and that is, why should the county be concerned specifically about the health of an art museum?
Exactly. This gets back to the kind of weaning off of the support of our cultural assets. I think we need to be really clear and have an honest conversation with our constituents in Milwaukee County of what kind of community do we want to be. Do we want to be a world-class community that has a great art museum and serves our veterans like they've served our country? Yes. And as a policymaker, I want to make an investment into those cultural assets. And this is what it is. As we're asking them to be more sustainable and self-sufficient, we need to give them the tools to do so. And that's what this discussion is about making an investment in protecting art and honoring the veterans who have served our country. And that's what this agreement will do.
We've heard about how dire the situation is in this facility, but I'm curious to hear from the two of you to describe literally what is at stake.
In terms of the physical
Absolutely.
Piece of this, what's at stake is the protection of a world-class art collection. It's completely unacceptable to have leaks in the roofs, to have window systems that don't function, and deteriorated conditions which have evolved over time. This wasn't a sudden change. When we're also being asked to present a world-class art museum, as the chairwoman has just stated, world-class is great for this community. It attracts new workers and new businesses and retains people as well. So we think that what's at stake here and what's critical for the art museum is to protect the art, the environment, and the experience for our hundreds of thousands of annual visitors.
Has there already been damage to the collection?
There's not been significant damage to the collection, but I will add that it has come at a cost that we have avoided that. We have taken extreme measures to make sure that the art is protected, both with personnel and with an infrastructure in place to make sure that we literally catch the water.
What about the physical condition of the War Memorial itself?
Well, and let's go back and understand what that War Memorial stands for. It stands for all the men that died in service back in World War II and Korea saving our freedom. And to walk onto Veterans Courtyard where our eternal flame is and where the names of all the Milwaukee County citizens that died in World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, that should be a place of honor. We can't afford to have crumbly concrete there. We need to have a place that the veterans and their families can be proud of.
The deal is widely described as a compromise. Are there aspects that each of you could be happier with?
Well, I think the best deals are always compromises. And in the best deals, both sides feel that they've gained much but also had to give up something. And I think this is how we describe this deal.
What do you feel you gave up?
Well, what we had to give up, of course, was some of our ability to maintain all aspects of the buildings. We recognize that the memorial pieces of this belong to the veterans and belong to the War Memorial. Yet, just to cite one example, the rooftop is the roof over the head of the artwork. So that's an example of a compromise. It's a critical one to recognize and to realize that there's a path forward on.
Well, and for 55 years, the War Memorial has been responsible for all operations at the complex. And quite honestly, and I've been there for a long time, and it's something that's really hard to give up. But we do realize that the art museum should be responsible for their space. So as much as it was hard to give that function of what we do up, it makes sense.
Marina Dmitrievich, were there things that you would like to have seen in that final deal?
Well, I want to conclude that the board's unanimous vote to support this historic monumental agreement is a salute and a testament to the hard work of these two organizations. 18 months, Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske came in and helped out. They put all this time together to come to a compromising agreement, and that is why the county board stood united and unanimously supported it. I really hope that the county executive signs it as soon as possible so that we can get working on it. Every day that goes by that it's not signed is a day that we could be working on drawing down millions of dollars, I believe $14 million in private funding, rehabbing the facility, and bringing in more tourism to this great county.
If the county executive were to veto it, are you confident that the board's unanimous support would lead to overriding a veto?
I would prefer that the county executive does not veto it and sign into law a unanimously supported resolution. But I do believe if that's what happens, I think it'll probably be unanimous in its override. I never want to predict that, but it would be a much more symbolic measure. It would turn over a new leaf in what's been a difficult year for us to work together and show this community that we can get things done.
Thank you to all three of you, and best of luck moving forward.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
Marina Dmitrievich is the chairwoman of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. David Drent is executive director of the War Memorial Center. And Dan Keegan is director of the Milwaukee Art Museum. We'll take a break now and in just a moment get some insight on the two directions electric cars are moving in. Besides forwards and backwards, that is. That is coming your way next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. When Chevrolet unveiled its electric car, the Volt, in this country, its TV commercials reassured would-be buyers that the car also has a gas tank, so it can still get them home if the batteries die. It's a phenomenon called range anxiety, and it's an issue for the Volt and the other major electric car on the market already, the Nissan Leaf. Both of these cars have limited ranges and appeal mainly to city commuters. But the makers of the Tesla say they've built an electric car that functions just like any other car in the market, drive it to work or across the country. And critics have been pretty impressed. Lake Effect auto contributor Mark Savage and our Dan Harmon spent some time in a Nissan Leaf recently. For sake of comparison, they wanted to find a Tesla owner, and in a coincidence of electrical proportions, they found one in my dad. They'll talk to him in a bit by Skype, but first, Mark Savage talked about his impressions of the Leaf.
I think people will think of an electric car much like they'll think of a hybrid, that it's probably going to have kind of low power and just kind of be there and do its job but be nothing fancy or spectacular. And this is nothing fancy, but it is definitely a nice driving car. It's, you know, it's a nice hatchback, and it doesn't feel cheap, and it doesn't feel slow. The the power is right there because of the electric power. It comes on, the torque is really good. So you immediately, you know, push it down. You can go from 0 to 30 or 40 pretty quickly. I think it's a little over 10 seconds to get to 60 according to the, you know, numbers on this thing. But that's very, you know, reasonable for any kind of, you know, midsize or so car these days.
And just for the record, you've had it 2 days. We drove it this morning. And what I liked about it, or what I remark about, is that you had the AC on, and it's, you know, not that it's terribly hot, and put on the Bose stereo, which, you know, sucks some power for the amplification. So this is real driving. This is not, you know, just being light with it.
Right. I don't feel with the Leaf you have to adjust your driving style. You don't have to think about, you know, gee, am I going to burn up all my miles here just, you know, because I'm downtown and I'm stopping at 5 stoplights before I can get on the freeway or whatever the case may be. It drives normally in that regard. And like I say, you probably have a little more power oomph, as I like to say, just to begin with. It's super quiet, obviously. You don't have anything but a little bit of electric whine. And they've attached a little beeper so that when you put it in reverse, there's a little beeping sound. I'm thinking mainly to warn people outside that there's a, you know, car that's not making any noise normally and it's backing up, so watch out for it.
Another impression that I had, and I don't know if this is on purpose from Nissan, which is it's kind of de-hybridized, which is it doesn't have all the gizmos and readouts and silly lights. It's very austere in what they did with it, so it just makes it even more normal, you know.
Right,
you
know. And I agree with that. I think sometimes you and I have commented in various hybrids that we've driven is that they have so many bells and whistles as far as telling you what your regenerative braking power is and how much, you know, you're putting back in and how much all the different charging levels are and so forth. This is pretty simple. It's basically got a readout in the middle of the day saying what kind of charge is left, as in 20%, 80%, 100% of your power, and an estimate of how many miles you have left. And I guess what I've been impressed with these first couple of days is the Leaf is rated at 75 to 80 miles on a charge, yet when I plugged it in last night or the night before, I got 98 miles, and today it says 103. And, that's a pretty good range. You know, you can drive around town, as we said beforehand, you could live in the suburbs here, drive to downtown, drive home, and not worry about, am I going to lose a charge and not be able to make it?
And that would describe your trip today.
Right. That's my trip today. I live out in the suburbs. I drove to my office, drove back downtown, and right now I think we had, 63 miles left after we parked the car.
Okay. What I think is interesting as well is that there's all – like every other car, there's all kinds of cars, and people think that electric cars are all the same. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. This is a car meant for urban driving and the kind of trips we just described. So, but this really contrasts with the Tesla, which is as expensive as you can go with an electric car, but it also has an extended range and it's more driver-oriented and more luxury-oriented.
Right. It's a luxury car, and I think of it as, you know, think of the biggest Lexus or Audi or whatever that's out there. I mean, it's a good-sized car, attractive design, I think, but it's aimed at the higher-end buyer and at a higher mileage range too. You know, they've got batteries in there that will take you roughly 250 miles as opposed to, let's say, 100 miles with the Leaf. So again, something you could take on the highway versus something, I drove 70 mile an hour coming down here. You can certainly take the Leaf on the highway, but you're not going to take it to Madison and back all in one day unless you go someplace and charge it up, you know, before you return. You know, the other big difference is that the Leaf starts at $28,800 before you add anything onto it. And the Tesla, you're going to be paying somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000.
Right. So, depending on which battery,
right,
and your options.
It's all based on the batteries. And what I was trying to explain to somebody at my office was, you know, the cost of the car that I'm driving, the test car, is $36,000. And he said, well, that's a lot of money to have for a small car, and it's a hatchback, but, you know, you could get 4 adults into it. But you got to think of it as kind of like if I'm buying the most up-to-date iPhone or, you know, fancy phone, I'm getting all the technology in there, and that's what's running the cost up. It's not that it's bigger. It's not that it has fantastic other features in it, but it's a good car at what it does, but it also has this new technology that is going to make it so your driving experience is a little bit different.
All right. Well, it's not enough that we can just talk about it. So we actually have someone coming on the line here who is a Tesla owner. And we just want to get his impression of the first, I don't know, I think it's been 6 months now. This would be Al Tyke. This is our executive producer, Mitch Tyke's father, who lives in the Washington, D.C. area. He bought his Tesla in December. So we just want to get some impressions from him about what he's thinking so far. So welcome to the show, Al. Let me just start by asking you your initial impressions. You've had the car for, I think, what, months now? Not more than a year.
No, I got it in at the end of December, the day after Christmas, actually, and I love it.
Wow.
No, it's by far the best car I've ever had, and I'm really enjoying driving it. I'm looking – it's kind of like when I was 16 and I just got my license, and I would ask my mother, can I go to the grocery store? You know, can I take the car? I look for opportunities to drive it.
Wow. Has it either lived up or disappointed or anything like that? What are your – because you've had it long enough to know.
Oh, it's definitely lived up to my expectations and exceeded them. It's in a lot of ways. It's particularly the way it it drives, the way it feels when I'm driving it. I think that's one of the things I like most.
Well, I know with the Leaf that I'm driving, what I like is that it has a lot of torque because that electric power comes on instantly and away you go. With a Tesla, I'm assuming that it even probably has more torque and a little more power to get you up to highway speeds.
I think it's about from what I've read, it's about twice as fast actually as the Leaf. It goes 0 to 60 in 5 seconds or less, actually.
Right, and the Leaf is right around 10 to 10.5 or something like that. So right, you're probably double the power right there.
Yeah, it pushes you back in your seat and kind of draws your face back.
That's great.
All right. Well, Al, what about the what everyone's calling range anxiety? Have you had to really plan your trips, or have you changed your lifestyle in any way? You know, tell us about that aspect of it.
Well, we've taken it up to New York City twice, which is about 240 miles. And we've taken it beyond New York to Poughkeepsie, which is we went to my nephew's graduation from Vassar up there, and that's about 90 miles north of New York. So we've done it. It does take a little more advanced planning. You've got to think about where you're going. You've got to think about where you can charge it. The nice thing about trip to New York, which is probably our most frequent out-of-town driving trip, is that they have one of these superchargers about halfway there in Delaware at the Delaware service area, and you can get 150 miles of range there in, well, it's been 30 minutes, and they are upgrading it so you can get that kind of a charge in about 20 minutes, which really makes the trip a lot easier. And the whole purpose of those things, that according to Tesla, is to get range anxiety out of the picture.
So what kind of range are you seeing, you know, if you didn't stop and get the supercharged, kind of a topping off your tank only with electricity, could you get 250 miles? How long could you probably go?
It depends how you how you're driving. City driving doesn't get you as much because it uses energy and probably the same thing in the Leaf, although I'm not really sure, when you're accelerating. So if you've stopped for a light and then you accelerate, that uses energy and it reduces your potential range. But if you're cruising along, say, at 65, 70 miles an hour on an interstate, and you don't need to slow down very often, you can the estimated range, which shows on the touchscreen, is I've gotten up over 300 miles. You know, I haven't tested that. You know, I'm pretty conservative in the way I drive, but I'm sure you could get that at the risk of event running out when you got up to 300 and something.
Right. Well, it seems like that must be the way the automakers are going with it here. I know Tesla said 250 miles, and you're saying 300, and with the Leaf, they're telling us 75 to maybe 80. And this morning when I charged it up, it had 103 miles on the meter. So I think that they're probably doing that so nobody overdrives and gets stranded someplace. But I think you know, from your standpoint, it sounds like the Tesla is something that gives you a much more freedom to go and drive and go cross country and you know, go wherever you want to go, whereas this the Leaf still remains much more of a city car, or at least, you know, around the suburban area here.
I think that's right. It's more of a commuter car. Tesla is putting in a couple of hundred, I understand, of these superchargers around the country, and I'm looking forward to driving out to the Midwest to see my grandchildren, both in Ohio and Wisconsin. Probably they'll have that. They're supposed to be implementing them along Interstate 80, so that you can drive from the East Coast to the West Coast using charging only with those superchargers. And when that happens, I don't know if I'm going to drive all the way to the West Coast, but I am going to take it on longer trips.
Well, make sure you stop by UWM and give us a ride here.
I would love to.
Well, I got one more question for you, and that's about, because you live in a really hot, soupy area of the country. Does that make a difference when you have the AC on all the time driving around D.C.?
The AC doesn't seem to drain very much, actually. It hasn't been hot enough for that to be noticeable. I think cold is actually more noticeable, but I think it's more the way you drive rather than the outside temperature.
Because they do have some, not necessarily the bitter cold that we have here, but it's cold enough to have an effect, I'm sure. What's that like in the winters there?
I'm told, although again, I haven't really experienced this personally, but I'm told it can reduce the range by up to 10%. But I think if that's really cold, and again, it wasn't that cold this past winter, so I couldn't tell you, and we didn't really get a lot of snow, so I couldn't really test it out in the snow and see how it handles there, which I sort of wanted to do.
So, Al, it sounds to me like you're pretty happy, and it sounds like easily there's 250 miles of range, so somebody can take a longer trip. You know, from here in the Midwest, certainly in Milwaukee, we're looking, can I get to Chicago and back? Can I get to Madison and back without having to stop, and whether it's a supercharger or at some other, you know, place along the way, a charging station. So it sounds like certainly the Tesla would be up to that.
I think certainly from Chicago to Milwaukee to Chicago and back, I don't think that would be a problem unless you did it on a city street somehow. I mean, you could use up a lot of energy just by starting and stopping. But if you're just going on the interstate and driving into the city and out of the city, I don't think you'd have any real problems.
Okay, Al. Well, thank you very much for coming on and giving us your impressions.
Well, I enjoyed it and always happy to talk about my Tesla.
All right. Okay, Mark, so does this back up what you have been hearing from Tesla owners, or because I'm sure you go on blogs or anything else and kind of keep track of what the owners are saying? It's generally 90%+ positive.
Right. And, you know, there have been some stories written, and I know that there's been some dust up about some of the stories that were written saying that their range wasn't as good as they had predicted. But obviously, from Al's perspective and from many of the owners, they're getting that 200 to 250 miles. And the fact that you can stop somewhere and charge it up along the way and continue on a road trip, I think that's what makes that car particularly attractive to somebody who's wanting the electric power. Say the Leaf, you can charge up in somewhere between 2 and 5 hours, depending on what kind of current you're using. And that has just improved for this newest model year, so that's great. But the main thing is you got to find a station and a place to charge it up. There are places. I looked just within 20 miles of my house. There are 19 charging stations in our area, some Nissan dealers, a couple Kohl's stores, and you know, a few other businesses in the area. So obviously you'd have to plan out a trip. If I were going someplace like Madison or Chicago, I'd have to plan that out. Whereas if you're in a Tesla, I think – obviously, first you had to pay the price, but you're getting something for that. You're really getting a lot more performance.
Let me just ask you about what other electric offerings are out there. And we've talked about the high end, and the Leaf is not low end, but it's certainly more affordable, if you will. So we've heard other things from other makers about having electrics. So what else is out there?
Well, right. And I think what you're seeing is the vast majority of the offerings are at the low end, or at least at the semi-low end.
Air quote low end.
Yeah. Right. So Ford has a Focus that's electric now. Honda has a new Fit that's electric. And the Fiat 500 has an E version that's electric, but right now it's only being sold in California, so obviously doesn't help us any at this end. Scion also has something. And, you know, I think what you're going to see is more and more of these coming out in the lower level cars, and it seems to be adding, you know, anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 to the cost of the car, depending on what it is. And I'm sure that's going to keep coming down, and you're going to see the ranges keep growing. And I think this Leaf has a very happy range on it right now for anybody who's driving in an urban environment. You're not going to really worry all the time of where your charge is. Now, I haven't had it in the winter. I hope I can get another electric car sometime during the winter, and we'll see how much that cuts into it. I know we've talked in the past about the Volt, which I had. And in warm weather, I got a charge of nearly 50 miles on it. And then in the winter, it was more like 35. Well, that's fine to get me back and forth to my office, but I'm probably not going to get around town and go to the grocery store and all that, all on electric power. With the Volt, of course, the gas engine kicks in and powers your battery, so it feels like electric power, but it's, you know, it's, you're starting to use gas. So if you want to have total zero emissions and you want an electric car, certainly Leaf and Fit and, you know, the Focus, things like that are the things that most people are going to be able to afford more quickly than a Tesla, which I'm sure is a beautiful car.
All right. Okay, well, that's happening in the electric car market still. Thanks, Mark, for coming in.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Mark Savage writes about cars for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and his own website, and he's our regular auto contributor. He talked with Dan Harmon about the Nissan Leaf. They also reached out to a Tesla owner and Lake Effect parental figure, Al Tike, as well. There was some controversy over a critical New York Times review of the Tesla. Mark Savage and Dan Harmon talk about that on the web at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then we'll talk with a Wisconsin writer, Susanna Daniel, about her book about a marriage fraying at the seams, a husband who sleepwalks, and a toddler who seemingly won't talk. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. It took 10 years for Wisconsin writer Susanna Daniel's first novel to go from inception to bookstores. Stiltsville told the story of a long and generally happy marriage and its sad ending. Her new novel is different in a couple of key ways. The marriage at its heart isn't so happy, and it found its way to print much more quickly. But there is one key similarity. Sea Creatures returns us to South Florida and the community of offshore houses called Stiltsville. It tells the story of the unraveling of the marriage between Georgia and Graham, along with Graham's struggles with parasomnia and their son's seeming inability to talk. Susanna Daniel made the drive over from Madison ahead of her appearance tomorrow night in Milwaukee. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
You return us to Miami in this book. That is where Stiltsville was set, and in part you even take us back to Stiltsville. Did you feel, was there some unfinished writerly business with South Florida that you felt you had as you got going with this?
There definitely was, and I really fought it for a long time. I wrote hundreds of pages of a book that did not take place at Stiltsville, and then one day I was telling my husband, I really just want to write about Stiltsville again, and I feel like I can't. Like there's some rule that I can't in, you know, creative writing world. And he said, well, that's just kind of stupid. And I said, oh, you know, right. It is stupid. I think I'm going to do that again. So I scrapped what I had and I started writing again. And Stiltsville had taken years and years and years to write. Once I really got going on this second book, it took 10 months. It was a straight shot. It felt really good to be back.
Well, and if I understand correctly, the hermit Charlie in mm-hmm. this book was inspired by a real live hermit who once lived in Stiltsville?
That's right. When I was growing up, we went to Stiltsville on the weekends. My grandfather built a house, and my parents used to stand at the kitchen window with binoculars and spy on this guy. And I thought that was normal. I now realize that it's not. And we don't spy on our neighbors, just so everyone knows.
But, in case they're listening.
Right. And he was pretty much always nude, and he had no boat. People would come out in boats and party with him. He was just basically this like hippie guy. And I never was all that interested in him as a kid. But once the Stilt houses were erased by Hurricane Andrew, I did end up thinking, well, where'd that guy go? This was his house. You know, we just went back to land. And that's the question that I kind of wanted to answer with this book.
What inspired you to write about the two significant maladies affecting characters in this book? There's parasomnia mm-hmm. and there's selective mutism.
Mm-hmm. You know, writers always say, like, write what you can't get out of your head. I think that's very good advice. And a lot of times I think as writers make the mistake of sort of latching onto something strange or interesting and not having like a personal connection to it. And you can really feel when that's missing. I am an insomniac. I've been an insomniac since I was in my early 20s. And it's interesting only in a, kind of a minor way in my life. But a few years ago, I was in the parking lot with my sleeping son in the back seat. And, you know, as you do, you stay where you are when your child is asleep in the back seat. And I turned on the Moth Radio Hour, and Mike Birbiglia, comedian, was, I think this was the first time Sleepwalk With Me was ever aired. It was way before he was on This American Life with it, way before he did the movie. But it was this hilarious monologue about a parasomniac who actually ends up like going through a plate glass window out of a hotel room and like running, bleeding across the across the lawn because he thinks he's being chased by jackals or something like that. And then he has to go back in to the hotel and say, like, I was, you know, I went through a plate glass window and you need to call the ambulance. And it's hilarious. And I was like laughing. But I was also thinking about the ways in which my husband and I cope with my insomnia in that small way that it impacts our lives. And then what would it be like to be married to somebody with severe parasomnia? And of course, I didn't write a funny book. I wrote a book that really, really, really asks that question. And the other thing is that my first son didn't start to talk for a long time. And I was a new mother and I was nervous. And I had the incredible people at Wisconsin Birth to Three into the house to evaluate him. And he's verbose now. Sometimes I wish he were a little less so. But I did ask myself for a long time, well, how are we going to cope with this? What are they going to be the strategies? And in my book, Georgia has a 3.5-year-old who doesn't speak. And a lot of the book is dedicated to sort of the strategies that she has come up with to cope with that.
I actually want to go back to insomnia. Mm-hmm. For a minute, and you talk about the different kinds of strategies that you and your husband have for dealing with your insomnia, which is, I'm guessing, at a significantly different level than Graham, the parasomniac in this.
Very minor compared to that. But you can tell, I think that anyone who has any kind of minor illness wonders what will it be like if that illness just takes a turn. And I actually could see that happening as an insomniac. I could see it becoming much worse over the course of my lifetime. And it scares me. And I think probably most insomniacs feel the same way.
Does it facilitate writing in a different way? I mean, do you, as you think about your circadian rhythms, if you will, does creativity hit you in a different time frame than it does for someone who's on the typical waking, sleeping clock?
No. I have often wished that I could be creative in the middle of the night because I get so many more hours. But usually I spend them watching television. Because I'm not fully awake and I'm not motivated and I'm a little angry the whole time.
The marriage that was at the heart of your first novel was a generally happy one mm-hmm. And a strong one with forces, you know, kind of tugging at it. That is not the case in Sea Creatures with Georgia and Graham. Was it difficult for you to write about a marriage in chaos?
It was difficult. Like, marriage is infinitely interesting to me. And I think that for the most part in real life, not in fictional life, we don't know what's going on in other people's marriages. They're very private and very personal, which seems obvious, but yet we all talk about marriage as if we know what's going on with other people. So what I really, really wanted to show was a sympathetic side, a very dark moment in a marriage where nobody is the bad guy.
Right. Georgia is not a flawless character who is dealing with a husband who is entirely flawed. They are both flawed and they are both not to blame.
Right. There's something that I really wanted to explore in Sea Creatures, which is that sometimes when two people have a child, there ends up being a kind of love triangle that happens. And there's a lot of parental ambivalence out there, and I wanted to show it in a humane way.
Who was the hardest character in this book to wrap your head around?
Probably Graham, because I think it's difficult to sympathize with anyone who doesn't just slobberingly love children. I personally sympathize with them, even as a mother, but I think most people tend to vilify people who don't want to be parents.
There's a significant historical event that undergirds part of this novel, which I won't give away, but that happened in Stiltsville as well.
Well, it's 1992 in Miami, so you pretty much know what's going to happen.
All right, so Hurricane Andrew undergirds a major scene in this book, and that happened in Stiltsville as well, the novel Stiltsville with the murders in Gainesville, actually. Why do you like setting these stories in the mid-range past among real, true events?
That's a good question. I'm drawn to that phase of history in Miami because it was a time when South Florida was going in a lot of different directions and nobody was quite sure what was going to happen. But also to me, it's very personal. You know, I remember being afraid when the Gainesville murders happened, and I remember Hurricane Andrew. I remember looking out and watching Hurricane Andrew descend on my house. So to me, that is the most autobiographical part of both of my novels, the setting.
And it's worth pointing out, I think, that it doesn't feel like a historical novel in most you know, conventional senses of the term. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, I had to remind myself why Georgia was going to get film developed.
She doesn't have a cell phone.
Right, exactly. I was going to mention that because there are points, you know, why can't Graham get a hold of her? Where's her cell phone? And I had to remind myself this was 1992.
Well, Ann Patchett says that you can't have cell phones in fiction. You know, they sort of ruin all dramatic device. So she keeps having her characters lose them.
I wanted to ask you a question about the cover of this book. I know authors don't necessarily direct the art on the cover, but there is a pretty major change between the cover of The Galley Proof and what ended up in bookstores. There was an octopus, maybe inspired by one of Charlie the Hermit is a hermit painter, and maybe it was inspired by one of his paintings on the original cover. It is gone, along with the waves on the finished cover. What were your feelings on how the cover ought to look?
I loved the first cover, but I was wrong. The second cover is better. There was a question of whether or not the cover should imply the sea creatures or show them, and it came down to wanting to leave them unshown. And I think that's right. It's a very serious cover, and the book is a pretty intense read, so I think it matches pretty well.
And the sea creatures, I mean, one of the things that Charlie paints, but there are some not so literal sea creatures that inhabit this book.
Right. And he actually doesn't paint. He draws. He draws very intricate, like almost medically precise drawings of sea creatures. And he becomes a kind of father figure to Frankie very quickly. He has this focus on Frankie that Frankie's own father lacks. Right. And he starts to give Frankie these little toys, these sea creature toys, from the beginning, and by the end of the book, which is just takes place over the course of a summer, Frankie has amassed like a whole army of these little guys, which my son also did exuberantly.
And all the while that this book was coming to pass, well, first of all, you were having another child yourself, which I imagine made some of the questions that you were writing about more murky? I don't know. I mean, was it hard to weigh these questions as real live events were happening to you?
Pregnancy has always given me a lot of focus. So it's a great time for me to write. I really put my head down and finished. I sold the book 2 weeks before I gave birth to my second son. But the other thing that in my own life, pregnancy has always been difficult to come by. And then also the decision to have a second child was a very big one in my marriage and in my life. And that's something that Georgia has on the page as well, her decision to only have one, and then some ambivalence about that decision. Charlie, who has had, you know, personal devastation in his past, weighs in on that as well. I think the decision to have one child is a really great, beautiful decision that is for some reason not given the respect that it deserves. And one day, maybe I'd like to write a book more about that.
When did the decision to start a writing studio come in?
I have a great novel group in Madison of female novelists, all of whom have one or more books, one of whom has eight. And a good friend of mine who has young kids and doesn't have a teaching job, Michelle Wilgen, her third book comes out in February. I said to her, you know what, this is what we're going to do. Because I looked around, I looked at Sackett Street Writers in Brooklyn, which has been around for 10 years, and it's an amazing program. I looked at The Loft in Minneapolis, Grub Street Writers in Boston, and I said, why doesn't Madison have this? Every time I visit a book club, somebody comes up to me and says, you know, I want to write a book. And I think I could be a writer. And I say, well, I think you could too, but you know what I needed? I need the class. I needed a class. I needed to sit down. I needed face-to-face instruction around a table where I got feedback from somebody who knew what they were doing. And Michelle and I do know what we're doing at this point. And I thought, well, you know, Madison has a university, a great creative writing program, but that's a completely different thing from what we're doing. And then they also have one day and weekend workshops, which is a completely different thing. You know, I think that there are a lot of people who want to learn to write in sort of a sustained manner, who want to do it in the evenings, working around their schedules, adults mostly, and basically around a dining room table where they can feel comfortable putting their work out there and forming a community.
Do you feel like you learned something about your own work from teaching it to other people?
Oh, yes, I do. And I get a lot of writing vigor from teaching, almost too much probably. And then I go and I just vomit it out all over the computer screen and it turns out bad. But no, I love it. I think that teaching writing is not necessary for all people, but that for some people it's a really great way of kind of getting their head around the discipline and the skill that goes along with the talent that they were born with.
Become a writer? Is there some innate thing that you have to get, or can you really start from the ground floor?
I think you can start from the ground floor. I think we all have tics, and that a person diligently writing day after day can learn to rein in his or her own tics, but that we can get there a lot faster if we give them feedback.
Susanna Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Susanna Daniel's latest novel is Sea Creatures, published by HarperCollins. She lives in Madison, but she'll be at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee tomorrow evening to read from her book. If you just can't wait, you can hear her read two excerpts from it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You'll also find a link to more about the Madison Writers Studio as well. As we learned in the interview with Susanna Daniel, some of her novel's focus on parasomnia was inspired by the real story of comedian Mike Birbiglia, who suffers from a serious sleep disorder and who once jumped through a hotel window, believing he was under imminent attack in his sleep. It's a story that inspired Birbiglia's book, Sleepwalk With Me, and a movie as well. He joined us in 2009 and described his unpleasant experiences with sleep.
Well, it's a big part of the audience's role in my show is they sleep. No, it's, you know, like you were saying, I talk about sleep because I have what's called REM behavior disorder, and it's a sleepwalking disorder of sorts. And I had a show, a one-man show off-Broadway that ran for 8 months that just closed in June, and it was called Sleepwalk With Me. It's a story about how I had this sleepwalking disorder for many years, and it got increasingly more and more dangerous. And I would think, yeah, maybe I should see a doctor. And then I thought, maybe I'll eat dinner. And I just went with dinner for years until this big incident happened that nearly killed me.
What does it feel like to sleepwalk?
Well, often you don't know when it's happening. The reality of it is as vivid as the reality that we're in right now speaking in. So you don't really know what's going on, and sometimes you don't know the next day that it happened. I had two serious girlfriends in the course of the like 10-year span that I was wrestling with this, and you know, often in the middle of the day they'd go, "Hey, did you know that you walked out of the apartment in the middle of the night?" And I was like, "No, I didn't. That's terrible." You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're doing detective work on your own life sometimes.
Were you afraid to see a doctor?
I was. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, I'd had some medical stuff in the past, and I just didn't want to deal with it. It's funny, you know, with this healthcare debate, and I don't even get political in my shows, rarely, if ever, but it's just topical right now. People say, "Oh, this is socialism and blah, blah, blah," and people are opponents to Barack Obama. And what I've found, because I've had many health problems over the years, I had a tumor in my bladder when I was 19, and I have this diagnosed sleepwalking disorder, and I find that I hate these health insurance companies. I despise them. I find them to be evil. I mean, really evil what they do. This idea that I heard this point made on Bill Maher's show recently by someone who's an expert in this area. I mean, I certainly am not, but these health insurance companies, they aren't doctors, they're not nurses, they don't have hospitals. They're just the middleman between you and the people who will help you. So why are we trying to hook up the middleman and we're making these record profits? I don't understand with my sleepwalking disorder, I have to go regularly for these sleep tests where I go to sleep and they monitor me through the night. I sleep over at the hospital, and it costs $3,000 to do these. And it's important for me to live because I had a near-death experience, and so they need to monitor this. And every year I do it, and every year it's denied by the health insurance company. And it takes about 6 to 12 months of resending it, reapplying. And this is health insurance I've had for years. And they just don't want to pay for it.
Raising the question of why you have health insurance if not for insuring a health problem.
I heard this point made recently, which is, health insurance is like car insurance except without all the risk. Because if you cease to be a good consumer of their health insurance, they just drop you anyway and they reject your claim. So where's the risk? Why do they make all that money? It's funny we're talking about this because I don't talk about this on stage, and hopefully you'll cut to some funny clips and people will go, oh, he's funny too. But it really is. It's an illuminating thing, this healthcare debate for me.
Well, and so tell us about the near-death experience.
Well, I actually told this story in This American Life, which you guys have here on the station, and I had an incident where I jumped out a second-story window in my sleep. But it's funny because I lived. If I hadn't lived, it would be tragedy. But such is the fine line between comedy and tragedy. And I was in La Quinta Inn in Walla Walla, Washington. Some people correct me. They go, no, it's La Quinta. And I'm like, that's not fair. You can't force me to speak Spanish. I didn't press 2 or whatever. But I had a dream that there was a guided missile headed towards my room. And I decided to jump out my window. 1, the window was closed. 2, I was on the second floor. So I jumped through a window like the Hulk, and I say that because that's how I described it in the emergency room. It's a very difficult thing to explain when one has jumped through a window. I was like, you know, the Hulk? Yeah, well, that's what I am. I'm the Hulk.
I jumped through a second-story window, and I landed on the front lawn of the hotel. I took a spill. I got back up, and I kept running. And I'm running, and I'm slowly realizing I'm on the front lawn of La Quinta Inn in Wyoming, Washington, in my underwear, bleeding. And I'm like, oh, no.
In terms of how that related to the show Sleepwalk With Me, it was a lot about denial. And the show is about how, you know, like I said, I would think maybe I should see a doctor, and then I thought maybe I'll eat dinner. And it took me this incident where I jumped through a second-story window to actually see a doctor.
Comedian Mike Birbiglia speaking with us in 2009 about his experiences with his sleep disorder. I'm Mitch Tyke. I trust we have not put you to sleep this morning. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll be here again tomorrow for more of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because fresh air is next.